seated. Morning. Delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom, but especially the students from Newman Catholic High School. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar in this court. We invite students across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're given materials about the case. They may engage in activities relating to the case. They come to court, listen to an oral argument, and after the second case, the students meet with a justice of the court assigned for that day to meet with the students. I say meet with the students, but everyone is welcome to join in that meeting. The discussion centers on the procedures of the court in taking the case and the procedures in the court in deciding cases. Does anyone here want a summary of the case we are about to hear? If you would you please raise your hand? No one does. Okay, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He's the justice assigned to meet with the class today. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will now call the second case for today, which is 12AP99, Outagamie County versus Melanie L. Arguing on behalf of Melanie L. is Assistant State Public Defender Suzanne L. Hagopian. Ms. Hagopian.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Suzanne Hagopian, and I represent Melanie L. My client is a young woman. She's age 24. Melanie is married. She's been employed in the same job in the same department store for 3 years. She also has attended technical college and a program for a certified nursing assistant. Melanie is also mentally ill, and she knows it, and she knows she needs treatment. This case is here because Melanie wanted to have a voice in her treatment decisions, but the lower courts determined that she was not competent to exercise informed consent. And the courts reached that conclusion even though the undisputed facts showed that Melanie understands the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives of medication. Melanie understands the nature of her mental illness. In fact, Melanie has a sufficiently good understanding of both her illness and the medication that she asked the county's doctor to put her on a particular psychotropic medication, and the doctor did. Nevertheless, she has been deemed incompetent. And I would submit that that determination is a misapplication of the statute, and it goes beyond to actually render hollow the very right that that statute...
In your estimation, counsel, where did the process or the evaluation go off the track, so to speak? Was it the circuit court judge? Was it one of the examining physicians, or both?
I think the first problem was with the examining physician, in that he did not use the correct standard.
What standard did he apply?
He concluded that Melanie was not capable of applying an understanding of the risks, benefits, and alternatives to her advantage. He acknowledged that she was able to express an understanding of the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives to the medication. But he concluded that she could not apply that to her advantage, when in fact what the statute examines is whether the individual is able to apply it to their condition, to their mental illness. And it's not a slip of the tongue. It can't be dismissed that way, because it appears in Dr. Davi's written report that way, and it appears twice in his testimony, both on direct and cross-examination. And I would submit, in reading this record, that that's his honest opinion. She can't apply it to her advantage. That's not the statutory standard. I think the only reasonable conclusion is that he could not conclude that she could not apply it to her mental illness.
Well, don't you think that's what he meant? I mean, how would you say someone would apply their knowledge to their advantage when you're talking about their mental condition? Wasn't he talking about her self-awareness and how she could or could not apply the...
I think he was talking about that she disagreed in part with the medication they wanted to provide for her. That he's the trained doctor, the psychiatrist. He's examined her records. He's aware that her treating psychiatrist, the county doctor, had prescribed 3 psychotropic medications for her. And Melanie wasn't interested in taking one of those. So in Dr. Dottie's opinion, she was not applying her understanding of the medication to her advantage.
When you say to her advantage, I know that's the words that you were concerned about and underlined in your brief and so forth. But you have to try to figure out, well, what was he saying? He was asked about her awareness of her condition, of the advantages and disadvantages of medication, and the statute requires self-awareness of how the medications would affect her, correct?
Well, the statute requires that the individual be able to apply their understanding of the medication to their illness.
That's right. How the medications would affect her condition. So I guess I didn't see an inconsistency, frankly, with his language.
Well, the legislature didn't say to their advantage. And I think the legislature pretty carefully chose the terminology here to apply it to their condition, their mental illness.
You could have prepped the witness and had him be a parrot and think the same thing and use the statutory words. I'm not sure you'd have any different conclusion from him. I guess I'm not sure, and maybe I'm wrong, that the doctor can only use the statutory words, and if he uses anything else to import the same thing, it just doesn't work. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I haven't argued here that as a matter of law, the county could never meet its burden because the doctor testified to the wrong standard. I do think it's a significant hole in the county's evidence.
Okay.
But I think it's a significant terminology used by the doctor because it reflects the very problem with the issue of informed consent being exercised by individuals under a mental commitment, all right? Because there is just an inherent problem of paternalism in this, that the doctors, sometimes the court, is going to believe that they know what's best for the individual.
What were your client's objections to taking the prescribed medications?
Well, my client, first of all, at the time of the recommitment hearing, which is the critical moment here, she was taking a potent psychotropic medication, Seroquel, and that specifically was the medication she had asked the county doctor to put her on because she had known she did well on that previously. So she was taking the Seroquel as prescribed. The doctor had also prescribed lorazepam for anxiety, but significantly it was prescribed as a PRN to be taken as needed. And that's what Melanie did. When she felt she needed it, she took it. When she didn't think she needed it, she didn't take it. Really, it comes down to one drug, Celexa, which is an antidepressant that the doctor was prescribing for anxiety. which is an appropriate use of that drug. That's not the issue. The issue is that Melanie didn't want to take it because she felt she didn't need it. Seroquel was also prescribed to address anxiety. And Melanie felt that her anxiety was adequately controlled by the Seroquel. And that is not a patently false, a delusional belief. She knows how she feels. She hadn't relapsed. She hadn't been hospitalized during her commitment. So it was a reasonable decision. It's the kind of decisions that we as patients are allowed to make. And that also an involuntarily committed patient is allowed to make as long as they are competent. Now, one of the things she cited, she didn't like the Celexa because she didn't think she needed it. And she was also very concerned about the number of psychotropic medications that she would be putting into her body. That's a perfectly reasonable concern. I think it's interesting that just 7 days after her recommitment hearing, the FDA issued a warning about Celexa that said a study had showed an even greater risk of heart attack than had been previously believed, so the FDA reduced the recommended maximum dosage from 60 milligrams a day to 40. Now, Melanie's doctor hadn't prescribed more than 20, but the issue, I guess the relevance of that is that the psychotropic medications, though they can be extremely beneficial, can also be very dangerous. And that is part of the reason the courts, the legislature, have been very careful to ensure that even those under an involuntary commitment have the right to exercise informed consent as long as they are competent. And it also illustrates...
Mr. Gulpian, let me interrupt you right here at this point. You felt the doctor went off the track. Did you feel the judge went off the track? And if so, in what way?
I felt that the judge also went off the track in that he, in part, based his determination that Melanie was incompetent on the very nature of her mental illness. She was diagnosed with a psychotic disorder, NOS, not otherwise specified, meaning that they're not able to give her a very specific diagnosis. And the court, right before it found her to be incompetent, commented, and I'll quote directly here, "The very nature of the underlying diagnostic malady is one that gives proper concern for and to the reliability of her own self-assessment, and for that reason, it's the court's conclusion," and then he finds her to be incompetent. The problem with that is that almost everybody under a Chapter 51 commitment is going to have a diagnostic malady that affects their judgment and reasoning, because the very definition of mental illness that applies to an involuntary commitment, it means a substantial disorder of thought, mood, perception, orientation, or memory, which grossly impairs judgment, behavior, capacity to recognize reality, or meet the ordinary demands of life. That's in Section 5101, sub 13b. So the right to exercise informed consent is rendered meaningless for a Chapter 51 clientele when the very nature of their diagnostic malady renders them incompetent. Now, she does have a psychiatric illness. She doesn't dispute that. What the legislature has told the psychiatrist and the courts to be looking at is whether the person understands the nature of their mental illness, in addition to having an ability to understand the risks and benefits of the medication. So I would submit that what this standard, and I refer to it as the second standard because it's the one that came later, that looks at both understanding of illness and the medication. It's a, you got to understand two things. And I guess if I was going to say, what would I like the rule to be from this case, it would be this. That an individual is competent to exercise informed consent about medication and or treatment if he or she is, one, capable of expressing an understanding of the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives to the medication or treatment, and, two, he or she is capable of expressing an understanding of the nature of his or her mental illness. If that individual can do both of those things, understands their illness, understands the medication, they are capable of applying that understanding to their illness within the meaning of the statute.
Because keeping I think that the subsection B that was written really in response to this court's decision in Virgil, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and in Virgil, we didn't think that there had to be self-awareness. And when the legislature passed sub B, they did it in response to that, trying to incorporate self-awareness. And it was not just self-awareness that someone was mentally ill, but an awareness of the advantages and disadvantages of this offered treatment to the mental illness. I mean, the word to his or her mental illness applies, seems to imply that there has to be some self-awareness, even though you might articulate the benefits and the disadvantages of taking a drug, there also has to be a self-awareness of doing those things in regard to what's going to happen to you with your mental illness. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, but I chafe a bit at the term self-awareness because I think it leads us down a path where we very easily are going off the rails again in this area. Just because of what I said earlier, sort of the inherent paternalism of all of this.
Yeah, and I can understand those concerns. I mean, I do understand them. I'm just trying to figure out exactly, given what we said in Virgil and what the legislature subsequently did, and the fact there is a focus in the statute which says to his or her mental illness, and it goes on to the other disabilities that might be present, which to me pretty much requires self-awareness.
Well, I have two suggestions along those lines.
Good.
One is to keep sort of at the forefront of our minds the context in which this determination is made, because the statute contemplates, as I read it, basically a conversation between the psychiatrist and the patient, because it demands that the individual be explained the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives. And interestingly, I think the legislature used the term the particular medication or treatment. When you read this, you think they're talking very specifically about, well, we think you should be on Seroquel because we believe that this will address your delusional thinking. You know, some very specific conversation. And as part of that, we'll discuss what the advantages will be, what the potential side effects will be, whether there are any, in the doctor's view, alternatives to that course of treatment. So if you have that kind of conversation going, the doctor, who should then be the one to testify, the patient may as well, but the doctor should be able to testify about specific facts, not just the opinion that this person doesn't have a self-awareness. Give us the facts that leads the doctor to conclude that they don't understand their mental illness. So when I use the phrase that the person must understand the nature of their mental illness, I've chosen that very carefully because I think what the person has to understand more important than the label of the diagnosis is they need to understand the symptoms of their illness, what their illness does to them. I think that's self-awareness, but I think I'd like the court to look at it more fact fact-based. So, for example, Melanie understood her illness. She understood that it involved delusional thinking and paranoid thoughts. She was able to recognize it. The onset of her two acute episodes, the first time she asked her mom to take her to the hospital, the second time she went home from work, she knew. She was starting to think that these other employees were FBI agents, and she had enough self-awareness to know they're really not, and I'm getting frightened, and I'm going home. Those are very specific facts that are so useful for the court to know. This person understands that they have paranoid thoughts. Then I'm going to be pretty comfortable as a judge to conclude that this person has an understanding of their mental illness. And then you look at, can this person express an understanding as well of the medication? And here we have, I think, a very useful record along those lines as well, because Melody could explain that the Seroquel, she knew she had done well on that before. She was doing, she thought, better on that than the Geodon, which she was on at the time she was released from the hospital. She didn't have the same side effects that she did with the Geodon. And I guess let's just talk about that for a minute, because when we talk about side effects with psychotropic medications, we are talking about things that can be life-shortening. You know, an increased heart rate can cause heart attack, you have greater risk of diabetes. But you know what? There's also the day-to-day side effects that maybe a doctor doesn't think are that bad. Dry mouth, like I'm experiencing right now, you know, shaky hands, feeling fuzzy, just not feeling quite fully together. Well, you know, a doctor can say, you should live with that. But the patient may feel like, you know, that really, I'm going to weigh these alternatives. I understand. I may be at greater risk of relapse, but you know what? My life is better when I don't feel like a zombie.
What does the record show about Melanie's complaints as to the side effects of the drugs that she didn't want to take?
Mm-hmm. Well, she felt, we don't have a huge amount of detail about her experience with the side effects. The one thing we know, and I apologize, this is a little distasteful, but when she was on, I believe it was the Geodon, it caused her breasts to leak. And she found that to be very unpleasant. But she also was concerned, even just generally, about the idea of taking more psychotropic medications than maybe she really needed. And so that was her primary complaint about the Celexa, is that it was she understood what it was prescribed for. It's an antidepressant, but prescribed, in her instance, for anxiety. And the Seroquel is also prescribed in part for anxiety, and she just wasn't feeling that anxious. You know, I think it's interesting that here we have a patient who is deemed by the courts to be incompetent, in part based on an examining, not the treating psychiatrist, but the examining psychiatrist who doesn't use the right standard, but concludes she's not competent. And her treating psychiatrist at that moment, the county's doctor, had prescribed one of the medications as a PRN. Doesn't that seem to assume some self-awareness? When a medication is prescribed for especially an outpatient to take as needed, when you feel you need it, seems to assume, and I think assume correctly in Melanie's case, that she was an accurate assessor of how she felt.
Ms. Agopian, what standard of review do we apply here? Do we look for an erroneous exercise of discretion by the court?
Well, the court must give deference to the factual findings, but much here is not in dispute. But even giving that appropriate deference then, the facts as found by the trial court when they're applied to the statutory standard is a question of law, reviewed de novo. So it's not an erroneous exercise of discretion. And I would submit that really the undisputed facts that this court should rely on in reversing the lower courts are these. Undisputed that Melanie was capable of expressing an understanding of the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives of medication. Everybody was in agreement on that. But also the court's factual finding that Melanie understood that she was mentally ill and she understood that she needed treatment, because the court actually commented, and this is on page 34 of the transcript, that everybody here, the providers, Dr. Dave, and Melanie, recognized that some course of psychotropic medication treatment is seen as appropriate. So the court recognized that Melanie knew she needed treatment, in fact, believed she needed some sort of psychotropic medication, but as the court went on to say, the question was what that course of treatment should be, and that's not really an issue for the judge. The issue for the judge was to decide whether Melanie was competent to exercise informed consent, and if she was, as I believe she was, under the statutory standard, then, indeed, she would be able to have a voice to make the decision about what that course of treatment ought to be.
Let me try to formulate a question. She's been taking Seroquel, is that right?
Yes.
And she did object to that?
No, she specifically asked for that one.
Suppose she decided I don't need it anymore. Is she entitled to do that?
She, you know, we would have to go back, look at the statutory standard. What are the reasons why she doesn't want to take it anymore? If her reasons are she doesn't think she needs it, she doesn't feel she's feeling very good, that doesn't now, for some reason, doesn't like the side effects of it, those would all be reasons that would not render her incompetent. If, though, at a particular point in time, she did not want to take the Seroquel because she believed that this was a drug that FBI agents had decided they wanted to poison her with, I think we could all be comfortable in concluding that that would be a delusional thought, or picking up the language that this court used in Virgil D, would be patently false. So her reasoning involves thinking that is patently false, and that would be an indication that she was not competent to exercise informed consent.
But, Counselor, I think when she was hospitalized in Minnesota earlier, before the Wisconsin hospitalization, eventually she did stop taking her drugs and ended up having difficulties thereafter. I think, if she tells her doctor she's stopping the drugs, then I think you can inquire why. But if she just makes the decision for herself to stop the drugs and there are no consequences because she is deemed competent to make choices about her mental health, I don't know how you give her the assistance she might need.
Well, two responses to that. One is she did stop taking the medication, but then she was fine for 2 years. So I don't think she becomes incompetent just because she might conclude that I feel fine now. I realize I'm at some risk here, but my life is better to be off of these medications and I'll take my chances. She made it for 2 years before she had another episode. The second thing is, if we're concerned about her well-being but also safety of individuals, that's what the commitment is for. That's what the commitment's for. And sometimes these two bleed together, the commitment, the right to exercise informed consent, they shouldn't. They're separate considerations and separate goals. So, for example, when Melanie was under the commitment, she had treatment conditions. And she had to stay in touch with the medical personnel, with the case manager. She had a whole bunch of conditions here. And if she didn't comply with those, as it says at the bottom here, I understand if I violate these conditions, I may be taken into custody by law enforcement and transferred to an inpatient facility. So it's the commitment that provides the safeguards, the ability to make sure that the individual is on track. But as long as they are competent, they should be able to make the decision that I don't want to take any medications. I'll take my chances. As long as they understand the implications of that decision, they retain the right to make that decision.
Well, here we had two proceedings, though. We had an extension of the what was a six-month commitment by a one-year commitment. And part of the reason she was outpatient committed rather than inpatient committed were the medication conditions that she had to comply with.
Well, I think it,
so they do kind of bump up against each other, at least
but,
in this case.
The judge had to decide what's the least restrictive. He did, outpatient, and then he had to make a separate determination about whether she was competent. Now, if she had decided no medication, she might not retain that outpatient status. And I think that's part of what a psychiatrist should explain to a patient like her. You know, that one of the risks you run here is that if you refuse the medication, you may end up back in the hospital. But as long as she understands that, she is competent. And see, this is sort of the paternalistic part of this,
well,
because
it is, Counselor, but you know, there was a finding here that she was dangerous to herself or to others. And that's a finding that had to be made. I know, and it was part of the commitment. That commitment was also extended. So I hear what you're saying, and you're saying it very well. But I think it's, to me, the two bump up against each other.
Well, I think it's tricky to pull them apart, but I think the statute really demands that they be pulled apart. And I guess I just ask, as you think about this, to not lose sight of what the commitment itself can accomplish, and that it is separate from whether the individual is competent to exercise informed consent.
In the last oral argument, you were here, I believe, a repeated refrain was, just because there is a commitment doesn't mean you're incompetent for all purposes. And isn't that your refrain?
Exactly. I wanted to stand up and applaud when the county said that. That's exactly our
no,
point.
No, it was both sides, but that I thought was very interesting. That
yes.
The county recognized that,
yes.
As it should, because that's a basic statutory point. And these commitments has a whole series, the last commitment I looked at, had a whole series of boxes. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I can't remember which commitment it was. Can you vote? Can you do this? Can you do that? Can you do something else? So, and sometimes it was yes, and sometimes it was no, because there are different capacities.
Well, and mental illness is especially tricky because individuals can function at a very, very high level, be very intelligent, and can have, for example, delusional thinking that is encapsulated into just one area and doesn't really affect their functioning in others. So it is, and Virgil D. very well makes the point, as the court also did earlier in Jones, that mental illness, that concept, and the concept of informed consent, they're not synonymous.
Thank you, counsel.
Could I ask?
I'm sorry.
Are all the conditions of commitment in the back of your brief?
No, and I apologize for that. They're in the record, however. It's a separate document, but it would have been entered at the same time as the order extending the commitment.
It's just not in your appendix.
That's correct.
Thank you. Mark G. Schroeder, Assistant Corporation Counsel, Appleton, Wisconsin, Outagamie County, representing Outagamie County.
Thank you. I am Mark Schrader, the attorney for Outagamie County, petitioner respondent in this action. There's a lot of places in this case where there's actually agreement between the parties. I think in the end, the place where there's a difference of opinion is whether or not a person should be found to be competent under the second standard, and I'm going to use that shorthand if that's okay, if they've got the ability to acknowledge that they suffer a mental illness. And that's the way it was phrased in briefing. It's a little phrased a little differently than that today, which I'm happy to hear because I think that gets us closer to the point. When we talk about whether, under that second standard, whether or not Melanie L. specifically was capable of applying an understanding of the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives to her condition, as to whether or not she could make an informed choice to accept treatment or reject it, I think it's important to note that it's true in this record she acknowledged that she suffered from a mental illness, but she indicated a number of other things as well, which I think call into question whether or not Melanie L. specifically really understood the nature of her illness, which is, I think is a different thing than being able to identify and acknowledge your diagnosis. Specifically, and it came up a moment ago, but if you look at in Ms. Scopian's appendix on page 150, it's the report of Dr. Dave. It does talk about the incident in 2009 in the state of Michigan where she went off her medications. And on page 3 of that report, page 150 of the appendix, she decided to discontinue it because she was feeling better. Not dissimilarly, above that on page 3, there's an indication about the incident where she stopped taking medications during the period of her commitment after her pregnancy had terminated, that she didn't immediately return to taking medications, again, because she believed that having been off the medications for a medical reason, that she thought she would do fine and could do fine without going back on the medications. Both of those circumstances, combined with the fact, particularly in the Michigan incident in 2009, with the fact that she deteriorated, combined with some other facts, I think demonstrate that Melanie L.'s specific understanding of her illness might have included the acknowledgement that she was mentally ill, but didn't include a full understanding of the nature of her illness.
Well, I thought that Ms. Hagopian said that one of the criteria would be, does she understand the nature of the illness, not merely the label?
But she did. In oral argument today, yes, she did.
Okay.
But I guess my point, Justice, is that if Melanie L. was incapable of realizing or accepting the notion that if she stayed off her medications, her psychotic symptoms would return, I question whether she understood the nature of her illness.
Well, it's possible she made a mistake and she was wrong. And it's possible that the doctor is wrong, that the doctor is not prescribing the right dosage, and when he or she does prescribe a dosage, a patient can get worse because this is an art. And there's nothing that tells you, point one, that's going to be great based on body weight or age or whatever you have. So what I hear you saying then is that in the past she guessed wrong, therefore she can't make a decision in the future.
I'm not asking for the court to find in a sort of bright line decision that noncompliance previously or a failure to take medication previously means incompetence now or in the future. I do think that those incidences where she went off her medication and had the reaction she did and developed symptoms again are indicative or are evidence of whether or not she understood the nature of her illness.
She developed the symptoms. What did she do?
Well, in 2009, if I could just refer back to make sure I get it right. Well, When she moved to Wisconsin, and this again is on the same page of the appendix, according to Dr. Dave's report, when she moved back to Wisconsin or moved to Wisconsin from Michigan, she began to feel anxious, as she apparently described to the doctor, took some leftover medication, and then when that ran out, she went off the meds again and didn't pursue it. In 2011, when she was under the commitment, she did eventually go back on the medication after, at least my understanding of the record, is after prompting from the county regarding the medication order that she was under at the time.
Mr. Schrader, do you agree or disagree with Ms. Hagopian's assertion that the terms of the statute permit self-determination in regard to medication, even if, for instance, it were explained to the patient that if you stop taking this medication, there is a chance that down the road you could wind up in another bad spot and being hospitalized? That's what I understood Ms. Hagopian to say, and if I'm wrong, she can correct me in her rebuttal portion. But I hear you saying something different. I'm wondering if you agree or disagree with that assertion.
I don't disagree after a finding of competence. Keeping in mind this was an extension of a commitment, if a person is found to be incompetent to refuse medication, and you have that conversation when you're pursuing a possible extension hearing, if they fully understand the nature of their illness, if they fully acknowledge it, and they're willing to take the potential consequences, I think that's one way to interpret the statute, yes.
But the standard here, and it's accurately set out in the transcript, and it's a pretty basic proposition, so if you want the site, I'll give it to you, but I don't think anyone, either one of you, would need it. The attorney, the corporation counsel, is questioning Dr. Davi, and the question is, and Melanie was able to express those benefits and risks to you in that conversation, benefits and risks, of course, to the medication. Answer, she was able to express, but was not capable of applying it to her advantage. Is that a parallel to the statutory standard that we're to apply?
Well, I think I acknowledge in my brief that clearly the doctor did not use the correct language. I honestly think it's pretty close. I really do. I have a difficult time parsing out the difference. I understand Ms. Gopian's position is that the doctor is either by implication or even directly saying she didn't agree with me and therefore she's not competent. But those aren't the words he used, and I think there's another way to look at that language and conclude that while he didn't use the right words in the hearing itself, that he may have, in his own head, been thinking about something approaching the correct standard.
Or is there a middle ground between those two choices to say, although you're able to meet the statutory requirements of being able to express the benefits and disadvantages, I think you're making an unwise choice. I think one of the analogies that comes to mind is, you know, I've known several people in my life who, after a diagnosis of cancer at the advanced stage, have made the determination that they are not going to put themselves through a course of treatment that may extend or prolong their lives. Some people may say that's wise. Some people may say that's unwise. But there it is.
Well, not comfortable taking the position that the doctor would be correctly applying the standard if he rendered an opinion that was based on his conclusion that she was making a poor choice, that he would make a different one. I think the question before the doctor is a little different than that. And I do think it comes close to what Mr. Goldstein represented as far as whether or not she understands the implications of the decision she's making.
Right, and that's mirrored in the statutory language. It right. says an informed choice. It doesn't say a wise choice.
Right.
It doesn't say, oh, the best choice that I, individually, whoever is speaking, would make, but an informed choice.
Yeah, I know, and I agree with that. And I'm not suggesting, and I acknowledge in my brief overtly, I'm not suggesting that a person, in order to be found competent, has to agree with the recommendations of their doctor or even the independent examining doctor. What I do think needs to happen is they need to understand all the implications of their illness in order to understand its nature, but also all the implications of making the choice to decline medication and what that means.
So what was she missing here?
In my opinion, she was missing a couple of things. I think when she talks at those two locations that I pointed out in the independent examiner's report, she appeared to be of the opinion that she could take the medicine for X number of days, or not even really a number of days, but until she felt better. And then once that happened, she could stop taking the medicine and have some assurance that the condition wouldn't return. Now, I know counsel indicated that it took 2 years for it to return last time. I actually don't think that's true. If you look at the record, it sounds to me like she reported to the doctor that symptoms actually returned when she came to Wisconsin, which I think occurred in 2010, which would have been about a year after her original diagnosis. And it seems to me, among other things, that Melanie's perception of how her body would react to going off the medication reveals a misunderstanding of the nature of her illness and the fact that this wasn't a transitive condition, but as the circuit court put it, an abiding problem that was going to recur unless it was tended to. And if she doesn't understand that, and I don't think she did, then the court, I think, correctly made the decision it made. I'd also note that the court relied on a number of different aspects, I think, in this case, to reach the decision it reached. Not just that history, which I've described, which, by the way, are specific facts and not just the opinion of the doctor. But she does talk about, at one point during her conversation with the doctor, and that report was introduced in evidence, so it was before the court, that no one's actually ever been able to give her a diagnosis or a specific diagnosis. And as Justice Abramson pointed out before, this is an art. It's not a mathematical formula. So diagnoses changed, and I'm not disputing that.
You've just described medicine.
Right. So, but if you go back and look at her actual diagnostic history, I think you'll see the changes themselves were actually relatively incremental. What you have is originally a diagnosis of depressive disorder with psychotic features. And then after that, the two other diagnoses that are noted in the record that I'm aware of deal with psychotic disorder not otherwise specified. Now, that might be more vague than she might like or that any of us might like, but it is a recurring theme for her right along that she suffered from a psychotic disorder and not just anxiety and not just depression. And when she's of the opinion, apparently, that she can go off her meds and be fine, I think, again, that reflects the lack of understanding of the nature of her illness. In addition to that, the court noted, and this I do want to point out, in making what I think was a fairly thoughtful decision, and I think that's reflected in the transcript itself when you read the depth to which he sort of parsed through what it is the court was thinking in rendering that decision, he does rely on her diagnosis. And he does certainly rely on the opinion of the doctor, as I think he's entitled to do in both cases. There is discussion in the brief, although it hasn't come up so far today, that the diagnosis alone can't be the sole basis or the basis for a finding of incompetency. I completely agree with that. But there's nothing in the law that I've been able to locate that indicates that the circuit court isn't free to rely on the nature of that diagnosis in evaluating the reliability of that person in trying to determine whether or not they're competent. And psychotic disorder is different than depressive disorder. It's different than anxiety. Now, I'm grateful, and I'm sure all of us are, that Melanie L., when she started to experience on a couple of occasions these dramatic delusions, that she self-reported them and sought treatment. That's fantastic. The court, though, found, after listening to the evidence, that she was not the kind of person, based on the evidence, based on the clear weight of the greater evidence, which is the way he phrased the standard, who could reliably conduct that kind of self-analysis. And I think that history that I've talked about today, that questioning of the people she was dealing with, the questioning of whether or not she's been given a diagnosis, a specific diagnosis, and the two incidents, and it's really actually closer to three when you count the return to or the arrival in Wisconsin, the brief usage of meds, and then going off them again, where she went off the medications, and at least two of those occasions appeared to believe that the issue she was dealing with was something that was no longer an issue for her.
You know, everything I read, including stuff that comes from doctors and hospitals and TV and radio, it's that don't rely only on the medical people. They're very good. They know a great deal. But you are in charge of your own health. And that you know you better than anyone else. And that it's your obligation to check things out, whether it be on the internet, whether it be with second or third opinions from doctors, but that you are responsible and that you should take charge, right? I mean, that's what you hear too.
Yeah, and that's been my personal experience as well.
That's right, and mine. So, why do we say just because she has a diagnosis of mental illness, maybe confined, why do we say that she is incompetent to know her, to question the doctors, question the medication? She can question. That, I think, shows signs of intelligence, reality, in touch with reality. It seems to me that at least at the limited amount I read, that she may be, maybe she's not, but from what I read, in a group that is most likely to be competent to refuse medication. I mean, taking the whole spectrum of people. And if we say she's not, who is?
Well,
that's a sort of rhetorical, but
okay.
My point is, you should answer that, because my point is, you cannot say, I don't think, just because she's questioning the doctors or saying she knows her body and she knows what the reactions are and she knows what she can and or cannot or will not tolerate. Seems to me it's a sign of great awareness.
I don't dispute that. And if we were dealing that with that out of the context of the remainder of the facts, I think the outcome of the case would be clearer. I also agree that, and as I said when I started, there's a lot of places where we agree here, but I also agree, and I don't think I'll catch a lot of grief from this from other assistant corporations councils across the state for saying
right, we won't tell them.
I agree that any competent person certainly has the right and as you pointed out, maybe the responsibility to question their doctors and to have doubts when those doubts are warranted. I think Judge Gage, in rendering his decision, acknowledges that tension there. I think he's aware of it. He talks about how she's an intelligent person and capable of reflecting on this sort of thing. But he also is counterbalancing that with the other aspects of the case, the other factual bases of the case, not just the diagnosis, that was telling him something different. And that does include... It does include the suspicion of the doctors. It does include the suspicion of Kate Sievers, the staffer from the county. It does include the incidents where she went off her meds on the apparent belief that she was fine on two occasions. Now, it's difficult to parse that out, and I use the word parse because that's the word that Judge Gage used. I think when you read his decision, you'll see how thoughtful he was about this and how he was thinking about Melanie L. as an individual and not as a person with this diagnosis, so she fits into this box. It's a difficult thing to do. It's as much of an art, maybe more of an art than medicine is, but I think when you put it in the context, that questioning in the context of the other evidence that's introduced in this case, that the court was entitled to make the decision it made. I think the burden of proof was met. And in the end, well, it's...
You had the burden of proof?
I did, the county.
Counsel, can you think of occasions where... I think these are tough calls. I've been on both sides of this where I've granted the order for involuntary medication and treatment and where I've denied that request for involuntary medication and treatment. And sometimes it's a really tough call. And it strikes me that this was one of those cases where it was a tough call. But there's a difference between someone coming in and knowing when they think they feel best and knowing what is best for them. And that's not the technical standard, I understand that. But it seems like she probably did have an understanding of some of the disadvantages, some of the alternatives. But it struck me that the doctor's testimony was her ability to understand the benefits of the advantages of the medication, given her history. And the question was properly asked by counsel. It was answered in the advantage form by the doctor, not the disadvantages and alternatives and additional language that's statutory. But that was on the heels of testimony relating to her past decision-making as far as deciding not to take the medication and then being committed. And in this particular case, being prescribed three medications and taking one of the three, albeit I think one of them was for her to decide when she thought she needed it. So she was sort of self-medicating, even though she was under a court order. And the doctor opined that if she continued on that path, he thought she would deteriorate again. And then the ultimate question was asked, why doesn't that support the judge's finding in this particular case? My first, and I think your answer is it does support the judge's finding. And then the second question is, it's almost as if this court and its questioning is making it sound like with every commitment also goes hand in hand in order for involuntary medication or treatment. Is that the practice in your county? Because it certainly wasn't in the county that I practiced.
No, it's not. I was thinking about this when I was listening to the first case, and there were some questions about the way things were functioning in Manitowoc County. I haven't sat down and tabulated it, but I would guess that roughly 20 to 25% of the cases I have a medication order involved, and that might be high. Probably 50% of our cases are resolved by a hold open. The next 30%, 35%, maybe a little more, are resolved with no medication order. And the vast majority, as in every case that I've handled except for this one, when there is a medication order, it's issued on the first standard, that inability to express the advantages, disadvantages, and alternatives to the medication rather than the second standard. So this is, in my opinion, a rare circumstance. And I agree with the premise of your question. This is a close case. There's no question about it. And I agree that these are tough calls. And getting back to something Justice Averson mentioned before, I think for the people, this is my opinion and my position, for the people that come through the system and end up with a medication order, she is, I'll acknowledge, on the high end of that spectrum as far as being close to being competent. But there are the vast majority of people who come through and actually get a commitment do so without a medication order at all. And they clear both of these hurdles, my experience, with relative ease.
Counsel, I want to focus on the opinion of the judge. And I'm looking at what for me is in the transcript, page 34 and 35 of the transcript, I think. And that's where he gets to his order and is summing it up. And he says, about three or four paragraphs here.
On 34 or 35? Starting on 34?
Starting on 34. There is a dispute. In this court's view, those things are not really in dispute. He's talking about whether or not she's a proper subject for commitment. This is a dispute about what the course of the treatment ought to be. And he, next paragraph, the very nature of the diagnosis that have been applied and the very nature of the underlying thought processes that in some significant part characterizes these diagnoses is a concern with delusional thinking to some extent. And he goes on and gets to a paragraph that says on page 35, it's also marked 145, on 35, it seems to me clear that a treatment provider ought to listen very carefully to, be mindful of, and weigh in a significant way her concerns and express concerns because she's capable of insight and she certainly is an intelligent person and has the capacity of thinking clearly to act with insightful intelligence. Now we get to a sentence or two that has caused some concern, and I note in the amicus of the disability rights, they also focus on this area. He continues, it seems to me that the very nature of the underlying diagnostic malady is one that gives proper concern for and to the reliability of her own assessment. And for that reason, and that's what was emphasized, not necessarily by the judge, but by the arguments here.
Right.
And for that reason, it's the court's conclusion that while able to understand and appreciate and articulate advantages and disadvantages, she is a person that by the clear greater weight of the evidence is not one and then uses the statutory standard, is not one who can reliably apply an understanding of the advantages, etc. So that's where the argument comes from, and the mantra of that was inadvertently picked up at last argument that mental illness does not equal incompetence. What do you do with this? I just don't know. The judge says she's capable of insight, she's intelligent, and has the capacity of thinking clearly to act with insightful intelligence. The next sentence is, but it seems to me clear that the very nature of the underlying diagnostic malady, which is the very nature of her mental illness, is the reason for the court's conclusion. Now, maybe I'm not reading it fairly. I mean, jump in and help me with this.
Okay, well, you're certainly reading that section fairly. The decision of the court goes on for some five pages. If you look at page 143, for example, and I shouldn't turn the page because now I just lost where I was looking. Here, bottom of 143, the second to last paragraph, it does strike.
Yes.
It does strike the court as cogent and circumstantially supported by the very nature of the adversities dealt with and the nature of the diagnosis that it's proper to say that Mrs. L, and then it goes on. That sentence there, just by way of example, circumstantially supported by the very nature of the adversities dealt with, that refers, I think that's the court referring back to the specific factual evidence that was introduced specific to this patient, not to any person diagnosed with psychotic disorder not otherwise specified or something similar or any other mental illness for that matter. I think when you read the decision of the court in whole, that sentence, that clause that you pointed out and that Ms. Agopian pointed out as well that's causing the concern makes a lot more sense, that it's not just this otherwise thoughtful judge saying, I'm finding you incompetent because you've been diagnosed with psychotic disorder.
Yeah, the judge wouldn't say that, I don't think, per se. But is saying The very nature of the underlying diagnostic malady is one that gives proper concern for and to the reliability of her own assessment, and for that reason is the court's conclusion. Is that just another way of saying it, though? That's the kicker here.
Well, as I said before, I certainly understand the concern with that clause, that sentence. But I think when you look at the decision in its whole and what he's referring to, and Judge Gage has a unique way of referring to it in sort of indirect fashions, he's considering the actual facts themselves, not specific to this patient, specific to this case, not just the diagnosis. Well, I've got a red light. So.
Justice Prosser.
I ask you a very unfair question.
Okay.
As I understand it, the commitment has been discontinued.
It is.
So obviously, the medication order has been discontinued.
That's correct.
Is that relevant at all to the issue in front of us?
I don't believe so, no. It was obviously relevant to the motion I put before the court in a somewhat late fashion, I'll acknowledge. But I don't know that it's relevant to the issue that are before the court now, given that decision.
It doesn't suggest that the court made the wrong decision, or does it suggest that the court made the right decision?
I think if we really wanted to argue it, I could argue, I think, fairly effectively that the fact that she was under the medication order for that following year prevented there from being that sort of departure, that fallback. I suspect Ms. Agopian could also argue effectively the opposite. But I don't, Justice, see it as terribly relevant to what's left before the court.
We make the decision as of the date. We treat the case as of the date the trial court had it. Is that correct?
Sorry?
We treat the case, we examine the case as of the date that the trial court made the decision.
Yes. I'm sorry, I misheard you. Yes,
no,
I agree with
all right.
That.
That's all right. Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Agopian?
The Chief Justice raised a question about who has the burden. And I think that it's something really important to focus on here, because an involuntarily committed person is presumed competent to exercise informed consent, and they only lose that right if the petitioner, in this case the county, proves that they are incompetent by clear and convincing evidence. So to say that the county met its burden here because she had stopped taking the medications at one point, that can't be enough. It just turns this all on its head, because that period, specifically they're talking about in 2009 after that first hospitalization, she wasn't even under a commitment. She could decide to stop taking the medication, just like any patient being treated with a physical illness can decide.
Was Dr. Dabe wrong when he testified that she had been prescribed? I'm looking at page 20 of the testimony. Three medications, and she was not taking two of the three medications, and that could have a negative effect. She could decompensate, show bizarre behaviors, potentially dangerous behaviors, and end up in an institution. What I thought he meant, during the course of this particular commitment, she was taking one of the three prescribed medications.
I heard that as well. And I was referring to the county, citing back to her earlier decision to stop taking the Risperdal that had been prescribed during her first hospitalization. If the county was going to...
I thought one of those three... She was not required to take all the time.
That's correct.
Okay. So she's now left with two medications that are required, according to the doctor. And she was taking one and not taking the other, and agreed to take the third if she needed it. I mean, that's what I read.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Just a
factual
issue.
I would sum it up is that she was choosing not to take one of the prescribed medications. But if the county is going to rely on noncompliance, the fact that she decided to stop taking a medication, then I think they've got to come in with proof that show that that was an irrational decision, that that was a product of delusional thinking, not just because the reason she gave, which was I was feeling better, I didn't like the side effects, and the practical reality, according to her mom, she stopped taking in part because she couldn't afford to pay for them. That doesn't make her incompetent. Maybe tells us our system doesn't work too well, but that doesn't make her incompetent. And Justice Ziegler, I agree with you in part. I agree that this is a tough call. I don't agree it's a close call. But, you know, I think it's a tough call for us because we want to protect people, and we don't want Melanie back in the hospital, and we think maybe the best course is for her to just do whatever the doctors say. But you know what? Maybe we really aren't protecting her when we think that way, because the amicus brief writes about the process of recovery and how studies show that people actually do better when they are part of the decision making, when they're consenting to the treatment. You know, someone like Melanie, she may have to live with this her entire life. And so the fact that maybe at some point she has delusional thinking, she may have to deal with that forever.
Do you know, counsel, does the record disclose in her closing remark, when she was given the opportunity to address the court towards the end of the hearing, she said, gee, I was taking three of these meds to combat the side effects of one of them. Are those the same? When I read that, I didn't know. Are those the same medications that Dr. Dave was referring to?
Yes. Yes. And I think the gist of really what she was saying is that it's just more medication than I think I really need. She did understand that the antidepressant was being prescribed for anxiety, and she just didn't feel anxious.
What kind of order does the court enter? What's the mandate? Because she's no longer under an order to take medication, isn't that right?
That is correct.
So what is it, rights declared? Is it that if it weren't moot, we would order her to take medication, or we would order her not to take medication? You see what my problem is.
Yeah, I mean, I think what the court should do here is reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. I think that as far as Melanie is concerned, you know, she's now seeing a private psychiatrist, and that was in the record here, that, you know, she got health insurance. So she was able to see a private psychiatrist. This doesn't impact her particularly, but you know what? It still really matters to her, because to be an individual who has to live with a mental illness, but to also be told in a court order that you're incompetent to be a part of the treatment decisions has a considerable impact. And I know that a decision by this court will be beneficial to the lower courts. I certainly hope you go our way, but the courts need guidance here. These hearings have become extremely short. There's very little facts presented. We need more facts. We need more actual testimony from the doctors about what this conversation was like with the individual. Just an opinion that the person doesn't have insight, that's not very helpful to the courts.
Thank you, Ms. Hagopian, and thank you, Mr. Schroeder, for our second case involving a mental health issues and concepts of when is someone competent. That concludes our hearing in 12-AP-99, Outagamie County versus Melanie L. The court is in recess for a lunch and will return at 1:30 for our third oral argument. Justice Gableman will be out is coming out as I speak.
Right away.
He exits. I never remember if that's left or right by theater terms, to speak with the students. We are in recess till 1:30.